Well, good afternoon. Yeah, not good morning. Good afternoon. 2:04 in the afternoon on March the 7th, I believe. It's a Thursday afternoon, and it's too bright out to actually see the screen on my phone, so I'm kind of going on a wing and a prayer here. 62, 64, something like that, out. It's beautiful. It's a spring day. Minutes, 18 first mile. That's not great, but I'm out. I'm walking. We're still marching through March. I wasn't sure I was going to make it today. Then I realized I have at 1:15, I had 1 hour before I have to go pick up the kids. So, yeah, 40 minutes of that is going to get chewed up by walking. Easy as that. The day just went away. Just went. God. It just like 5 minutes ago, it seems like it was 8 a.m. So, in the last 24 hours, I've run across a bunch of different things. One was, actually, my education community came through with Clarence Fisher up in, what is it? Something Lake. Yeah. It'll come to me anyway. Canada. It's a small town up in Canada where he is also the mayor now. And, so he was watching some TED Talks, and there was one about, I don't know if it was a TED Talk or not, but there was this one video, it was on YouTube, put a link for it. It was about the wizards of the modern era. And there's a lot of noise out in the edublogosphere about learning to code, learning to program, and how that opens doors, not just because it opens doors for jobs, it opens doors for understanding, it opens doors for creativity, and it opens doors for people to create and to have their creations take on almost a life of their own. But they had Mark Z and Bill Gates and a bunch of other people, guy who did Dropbox, a couple of women who have done some really interesting things with online sites. So it was interesting for me to watch that. He's really taken this to heart, because one of the things that he's aware of in his classroom is that they don't use computers as tools for learning. They use computers as tools for access. They use the tools for communication, for things other than creation. Text, word processing, and music processing, and that kind of stuff. Yeah, fine. But that's not programming. Or if it is, it's programming at a very high level. He's talking about programming at a very fundamental level, and I have to agree with him. It's going around. It's something in the air, because Stephen Downs over in Canada, over in Moncton, said the same thing. It has been saying the same thing for quite some time. And Dave Weiner, who is one of the guys who created RSS and made the blogosphere possible, has been saying the same thing for a long time, is it? Learning how to code is really the lingua franca of the modern era. Those who know how to code have huge advantages over those who don't. Those who are the Illuminati of the digital age. In a real sense, the digirati, not just the way that the term has been corrupted to mean anyone who uses digital tools, but someone who actually can understand and create digital tools. It's an important skill. And it's interesting to me that my kids code. They don't do it very often, and they haven't done it for a while, but my elder daughter wanted to learn Python. So I got her a book, and she learned Python. And I don't know if she still uses it or not, but she knows how to work it. She knows how code works. She knows how web pages go together. And even something as simple as HTML markup is code. It's not really the same as PHP code, for example, or C code, or even COBOL, or one of those languages. One of the languages that I grew up with, the first language I learned was BASIC. That was way back in the Dartmouth days, I graduated in 70, and I was when I was in junior high, so what we would call middle school today. It's hard to believe that I was programming computers when I was in middle school. And so that had to have been 63, 62, and I'm 60 now. So half a century. And programming has changed a lot. I mean, in those days, I mean, one of the reasons I didn't get into computer science right out of high school was the punch cards. Punch cards was the tool. Punch cards was how you programmed a computer. Punch cards was how it worked. IBM 360 was the big cheese. And there were no terminals to speak of. They were all teletypes. There were very few terminals in the early 60s. I just couldn't see myself fiddling with cards. Little did I know. But the interactive tools changed everything. The CRTs changed the world. CRTs made it possible for personal computers. Without CRTs, there would not be personal computers because the input-output would be too awkward. CRTs changed that. So, yeah. He's starting a new initiative. He's been running with the Idea Hive. And he's come up with C cubed, C to the third power. Code, create, communicate. It was interesting to read his thinking about this. It's something that I've thought for a long, long time, is that we don't use these computers. Even as teachers, we don't use these computers as levers for learning. We use them for tools for communication. When in fact, there's a huge, huge, huge benefit to being able to use a computer to learn with. So I learned statistics by programming statistical functions. So in BASIC, yeah, it was really terrible, but it worked. And so I was able to actually check my statistics homework by putting in the variables and determining whether or not the statistics that came out of the computer actually agreed with what my calculator said, which was kind of stupid, I suppose. But it was fascinating for me to operationalize the process. I said, how do we go through, how do we take a series of numbers, how do we determine what is the mean? We have to go through an etymology. How do we determine what is the standard deviation? How do we determine what is the mode? How do we determine what is the median? How do we determine, what do those things mean in terms of this list of numbers? What does that tell me about this list of numbers? So I gained a huge, huge advantage over the rest of the people in the class. Because when it came time to start talking about standard deviations, it came time to start talking about median and mode, when I started to talk about outliers, a value that was so far outside the realm of possibility, in terms of standard deviations, it's like six standard deviations above the mean. So how can that one data point be that far out? The answer is, statistically, it's not part of the same sample. It's not part of the same population. That's the problem. That's the issue. So it's an outlier. It becomes an interesting point on the graph, but it doesn't tell me a lot about the population as a whole. So fascinating to think of how I've used statistics as a platform, Monkpo, and code, programming, to learn about statistics, to learn about these properties of numbers that, taken in aggregate, tell us something, whatever, assuming that they might actually tell us something. The other thing that came across my desk in the last 24 hours was the TED Talk from Amanda Palmer. And I don't remember where this linked from. It might have been Boing Boing. But it came across in my feed. And I was actually checking my feed last night. And there's a third thing that was actually in the Shatskin file that I talked about yesterday, that I actually went back and read it again in depth and realized that there was more meat there than I thought the first pass. But anyway, Amanda Palmer, The Art of Asking, and Dresden Dolls, and how she signed a major deal, and how her big publishing deal, in this case music record label deal, went a little bit awry when they only sold 25,000 records, which for Amanda Palmer was a huge number, but for her record company it was $9 million plus short of a golden album. And so it wasn't mass media, it was niche, and it wasn't something that they wanted to play with. And so they went away, leaving her alone again. So she came to realize that 25,000 people was important, and how she would go on tour with her new band, and how they would invite people from the local area to come and jam with them, to come up on stage and do a set with them, to do, you know, whatever, a collaborative effort to put on a show for the locals. And they get paid in beer, they get paid in having a good time, and they want to come and play with Amanda Palmer, come on down. Now, coming from the podcast world, coming from the podcast community, coming from a community of, well, all of you, and all of the people that I listened to and participated with, and with whom I will participate again. This is logical. This is perfectly legit. This is perfectly normal. This is the how things work. This is, you know, 25,000 people is a good fan base. That's, you know, if you can sell something to them every year, that's a good income. So she did a Kickstarter, and apparently she's looking for $100,000 to produce a record. And the people who signed up would get a copy of the record, and then she'd sell the record. But it's Kickstarter. I mean, it's basically Kickstarter. And she cleared $1.2 million. And with that $1.2 million, earned the approbation of a whole herd of people who thought that her practice of couch surfing, of crowd surfing, of inviting the locals to come and play with her on stage was somehow subverted by the fact that she'd done $1.2 million with a crowdfunding. She should be paying in cash instead of kind. She should be paying in money instead of kindness. And it's like, really? Seriously? But it's apparent that the people didn't really understand what it was she was doing, and she didn't really understand the richness and the depth of the connection that she has with her fan base. For me, it seemed ultimately rational. It seemed perfectly within the realm of my experience, within the realm of what I understand to be the world of modern media. And yet, the question that she used to really underscore how she operates, because now she pretty much gives her music away for free, and if you want to donate, donate, which is sort of how I started, by putting the podcast out for free, and if you wanted to donate, donate, and that worked pretty well. It worked well for me, it didn't work so well for other people, but it's, you know, it's one of those things. It's it either works or it doesn't. But the question that she keeps getting asked is, how do you make them pay for the music? And she's thought about that for a long time, because it's not something that had ever occurred to her, is how do you make them pay for the music? How do you let them pay for the music is perhaps the right question to ask. And that struck a chord with me because of, you know, records and books. How do I let people pay for the stories? Well, I put a donate button on my page, and I get donations, and I don't, you know, it's not a big number, but it's some. I get donations. I still get donations from Patio Books, and I haven't put a new Patio Book up in over a year. It works out. I need to put out some new books, because Evo needs more money. We need to get to keep the servers alive. Without Patio Books, most of us would not have gotten our start, and without Patio Books, a lot of people won't be getting starts, so it behooves me to make sure that it continues, and I will. I don't think that it's in any danger, quite frankly, but that leads me to the Shatskin Files and the latest post that he made about whether trade publishing is more similar to newspapers or to their advertisers, and in many ways Shatskin argues that it's closer to advertisers than it is to the newspaper. I'm not sure I agree that it's part of either, really. But he quoted some guy, and I want to say somebody Clay somebody. I've completely blanked out on his name. But he classified the evolution of media, and since he's really talking about newspaper media, not, you know, print media, he's not talking about media in general, but I think it applies across so many different media that I think it's an important idea. The idea of infinite media. We're no longer in mass media, we're in infinite media. We're in everyone, and it's not strictly speaking true, it's not infinite, but this idea of mass customization, the idea that a niche market of 25,000, which goes back to Amanda Palmer, 25,000 is a big audience for somebody like me. It's nothing for somebody like Random House. But I don't need Random House to reach 25,000 people. And Random House doesn't want to talk to me. Well, I don't really want to talk to Random House. I guess it's a more proper way to say that. But anyway, it isn't a question of mass market anymore. It's not a question of market fragmentation, even, because the big aggregators still aggregate. You know, Yahoo and Google and YouTube are still the big dogs. They are the power curve leaders, which leaves very little for what used to be the mass media, where 80 million viewers was a good TV audience. Now, 80 million views is a good beginning on YouTube. So it's an interesting change, it's an interesting shift, and it's interesting to me that the media people, the newspaper people, are the ones who are seeing it, that an 18-minute mile, almost 19 minutes on the second mile, that means it's getting close to being time to leave for the kids, which also means that I'm close to coming to the end of my walk, but it's interesting to me to see that I reach more people than the average daily newspaper in the U.S. How is that possible? The answer is really quite easy. I'm not a newspaper, which sounds weird, but it's nevertheless the truth. At any rate, I am at the back gate. Tomorrow is another day, and with any luck at all, and although they say it's going to be snowing, with any luck at all, I'll talk to you then.